Okay, good. I don't think I've ever closed off a meeting before. So this title I came up with rather late, so the undecided self. Unlike the undecided voter, this is not a fictitious beast, and I think that we're actually onto something here. And let's see how this goes. So two topics for this talk, memory and anticipation. So memory is how the cell sort of remembers where it's been, how the past imprints what goes on in the cell right now. And anticipation is what the cell would do in terms of predicting the future, okay? And we'll see that that's not really what it does. It does not predict the future, but how does it deal with uncertain future? Also, these words quite well sum up the state of the project. Memory project is all done in my past. Anticipation, I have no results for you, but I'll present some of the ideas, tell you what the experimental system is, and all your feedback over there will be extremely valuable. So, first part of memory. The very specific definition of memory I'm talking about, memory that's stored inside a single cell, the hallmark is that a transient stimulus, a pulse of chemical, something like that, will produce a persistent response, a prolonged change in gene expression. And one easy way to do this is just that the initial stimulus deposits some molecules inside the cell, and these molecules just hang around forever. And that's, that could be memory, but that's not the kind we're talking about, where if you follow any single molecule that's inside the cell, these molecules die within 20 minutes, 1 hour, sometimes here like that. But the state of the cell is sustained for generations, so hundreds of generations. In fact, you'll see exactly how long. And this is it's an extremely useful thing to think about, because it occurs in real biology in all kinds of contexts. Okay, so one we've been hearing about is in Drosophila development, for example. We heard from it yesterday that there's these feedback loops that allow cells to remember the initial state, the initial pulse of morphogens, and subsequently they maintain the stripes, even once that initial, whatever signal that set up the initial stripes has been removed. And here's a cool example. So apparently during, and I don't know much about it, but during axon guidance, so here you have the neurons that start off somewhere near the eye, say, and you have to set down axons that go into the brain. And the way this is done is that these cells search out for intermediate targets. And there's several intermediates that then lead it all the way to the final point. And so this is really quite remarkable. What happens is that there's a zone of secretion of a certain chemical to which this axon is attracted. Okay? So once it reaches the center of that zone, the axon actually changes its behavior, because now it gets repelled by that same chemical. Okay, so from now on, the state of the cell is quite different than what it was before. This is a cell that doesn't like this chemical. This is a cell that does like it. Okay, so a transient stimulus, something that happened while it was right in the center of the zone, affects it for the rest of its development. And a single cell example is quorum sensing. So it's known that bacteria secrete chemicals to communicate with one another. And once the concentration of this secreted chemical reaches some threshold, then they can change their behavior. They can become virulent, something like that. And it turns out that once it reaches this threshold, you can then disperse the bacteria, and they're still in a virulent state. So that, again, they have memory. And just a quick slide. This is the one I put in for general audience talks. Don't need it for this one. What's inside a cell, I'm going to look at genetics mainly. So you have a promoter which controls whether the gene is on or off. And there's some kind of signals, transcription factors, associated factors that regulate expression, and then you have the gene, which is expressed. So generally, when you have the factors present, then the gene is expressed, and otherwise it isn't. So I compare it to a mic, and there's sound coming in, and speaker sound going out. But everybody knows then when you turn the speaker around, then you get this high-pitched squeal, this feedback. Basically, when you need the output of the gene in order to have the gene to be expressed at all, then a transient pulse of stimulus will produce a persistent response. So everybody here, I know, knows this and believes this. So what we wanted to do was to look at general properties of this kind of positive feedback. General meaning when you put it in a molecular context, when you put it inside a cell, then what does it actually work out the way you hope it does? And of course you turn to E. coli for the cleanest general system. And the idea is that you look at positive feedback loops, or one positive feedback loop in E. coli, and you try and see if there's anything general you can say about how these things will work inside living cells. Okay. So the lax system, the only system for which we have enough data. Quick summary of what's going on. So this is, you're going to see, there's positive feedback in lactose regulation. So this rectangle is an E. coli cell, and in the chromosome of E. coli, there's a group of genes called the lac operon, controlled by the lac promoter. There's three genes over there. And in the default state, these genes are repressed by the lac, the famous lac repressor. So when, in the absence of any stimulus, nothing is going on here. There's no expression. Okay? But suppose there is expression. One of the genes that is expressed, the middle one, LacY, codes for a protein also called LacY, the lactose permease. So this is a membrane-bound protein. It's a proton pump, and its purpose is to suck in against the gradient, right? So active transport of lactose, the sugar, the preferred substrate of this system. So over here I said TMG. TMG is a thiomethylgalactoside, which is an analog of lactose. It's a molecule that looks very much like lactose. Yeah?
When you say it's a preferred source, I thought that glucose is a preferred...
No. The substrate of these particular... But there's actually... Even these guys are not... So there are weak specificity substrates of these enzymes, right? So, but the strongest one is lactose. But there are others. You see, the TMG is one of them, which is a lactose analog, which does bind to the pocket of LacY and get transported across the membrane. In fact, it also binds to LacI. So the important thing about TMG is that it's not metabolized. Right? So you can add it in your beaker, you can grow these cells out, and it's not going to get depleted. It just enters the cell and causes... So LacY transports TMG into the cell, and what I was saying was the TMG actually binds to the repressor, LacI, and causes it to stop functioning. So it does, once TMG, these molecules of TMG, bind to the repressor enters a conformation where it cannot bind DNA. But in fact, the binding is completely abolished, and so you do have expression. So this is the positive feedback. It produces LacY, it sucks in the sugar, which leads to the production of more LacY. And the way you want to follow this in an experiment, one way to do this would be to tag one of these proteins with GFP. And we chose to do it a slightly simpler way, which is somewhere else in the chromosome, we integrated another copy of the lac promoter, and we put GFP under its control. So when GFP is on, that means the lac operon is also on. Okay, or when GFP is being expressed, the lac operon is also being expressed, because they're under exactly the same control. So, simple... model, a seemingly simple model to describe what's going on here. One thing I have to say is that all the individual steps in this model have been very well characterized over 50 years of biochemistry. Okay, so all these rates are known and so on, but I'm not going to actually use any of those values. I'm just putting down a sort of parametric model. So the important quantities here are, of course, LacY, the transporter, extracellular TMG, intracellular TMG, which is the only thing the cell can sense, right? And the quantity of repressor. So the repressor, the active fraction, the fraction that can bind DNA as a function of the total, is a decreasing function of intracellular TMG. That's what this repressing arrow means. And this coefficient of n, or this power of n, actually comes out because it takes more than a single molecule of TMG binding disable the lac repressor. It takes two molecules of TMG binding to disable the lac repressor. So n is equal to 2. Again, established very well biochemically. But it's okay. So it takes.
It's because
the lac repressor is a dimer. Actually, it's fairly complicated. So the lac repressor is a dimer, but it has two predominant binding sites on the DNA. So there's actually two dimers going on. So four binding pockets for TMG. But if you actually do the measurement, n comes up very, very close to 2. But of course, it's an effective coefficient that comes out of all the rest of the stuff going on. Anyway, so N is...
The fact that there are two binding sites is sort of immaterial, right? What you need to control is the definition of active
I-dimer. So the fact is that it's only when both of them are... No, so it's not the dimerization that's the problem. So lac I dimerizes very well. So the monomeric concentration is basically zero.
Yeah, that's not... But you want to... You need to bind with T and G to both sides
exactly.
of the dimer, right?
Exactly. Well, that's one way to think about it. It's a little more complicated, but that's one way to think about it.
Why is it more complicated?
It's more complicated because it's actually DNA looping, and there's two dimers that cause the looping to happen, and so you can bind to any pair of sites here, and so there's...
Right.
There's
all of that is controlled by one variable, which is the
concentration of
active lac I dimer, right?
Yeah, correct. Exactly. So at any rate, this you can measure that very equation just by doing biochemistry, and this comes out to very close to 2.
But I think one of the things said here is that that N is 2 because of
the dimeric property, exactly.
But the looping that you're talking about should rather show up in this 1 over R over R naught.
Over here.
Which perhaps is not 1 over R, but 1 over R squared or whatever.
Yes. But the point is it's not, it turns out not to look like 1 over R squared. Because
which
one of them binding.
That the loop doesn't contribute that much.
What it does is it contributes to the mechanism of repression, but not to the kinetics. So when one dimer is bound, then both of them are bound at the same time. We can get into this. We can get into it. But look, you can measure this individual function. You can measure this individual function. There's very little power going on here, and there's a factor of 2 going on there. So what I'm saying is, look, just by biochemistry, even if we didn't know about loops and all that, I could have written down these equations because people measured these functions. Okay, so we get to the second equation, which is the rate of creation of lac Y. Right? So the more repressor you have, the more active dimeric lac repressor you have, right, the less the expression is. And it works out in this hyperbolic fashion. The more repressor you have, the more binds to the predominant site, and the less fraction of the time the DNA is actually expressed. Okay? And then you have this degradation term, which I've taken to be just dilution. Okay, so there's some prefactor here, which is actually something like 1 over the cell doubling time. Okay, so we're working in units of cell doubling time.
Wait, so tau y is your dimension.
Right, exactly. And thirdly, once you have permease expressed outside the cell, then it turns out that permease is usually the saturating variable. Right, so the rate of uptake of TMG is linearly proportional to the amount of permease. And some prefactor, which is monotonically increasing as a function of extracellular TMG. Okay, so beta you should think of as representing the extracellular concentration of TMG. The more TMG you have, the higher beta is. And then you have metabolism, dilution, and degradation of TMG inside the cell. Okay. So pay less attention to these equations, but more to the interpretation of these quantities.
Wait, so I thought TMG was actually stable.
Yeah, so but there's dilution.
So therefore, tau x is equal to tau y.
It could be, so we cannot measure that. Okay, I have no way to go in and make this
amount of lac repressor is kept constant.
The total amount of lac repressor is kept constant in the sense that it's expressed from a constitutive promoter elsewhere.
So that's why there is no term.
There's no term with DRD.
X variable. Right?
Correct. Yeah. The amount of lac repressor is kept constant. It's very, very low. I'll come to that later, but it's the average is constant. You put all this together and you make some one effective equation. The only reason to do this is less to look at the dynamics and more to look at the fixed points. Okay, so what I'm interested in today is looking at the fixed points of these equations. In which case, these times really don't matter. That's why I've taken them to the left and they drop up. The rate of creation of lac Y. There's some creation term. There's some degradation term. If beta is very, very high, saturating very, very high concentrations of extracellular TMG, right, then this equation just goes up to alpha minus y. In other words, alpha is the maximum rate of expression of this promoter. It's something we can actually measure.
I don't understand the logic here. You can do your fixed point analysis of those two equations.
Yeah.
But here, since the time constants are the same, strictly speaking, not allowed to write down the fixed point.
Right. So this equals right. So this actually, I should take that away and just say 0 is equal to these things. So that's what I mean. So unfair, not really true. But it does give you the right fixed point. So, but just to give you, I want to put down this equation to give you an idea of what these things mean. Okay, so at very high beta, alpha is the maximum activity of the Lac operon. When beta is zero, when there's no TMG, then the expression of the operon actually goes to alpha over rho. Okay, so rho is the factor by which this operon is repressed. So in practice, rho goes out to something like 1,000. The operon is repressed by a factor of 1,000 in the absence of the inducer. Okay? So that's something we can actually measure. And people do. And of course, we have extracellular TMG. Any questions? So, as I was saying, so there's this, also this fact, this fluke coefficient. So, we all know how to do this. You can write down, you can sort of do a differential equation, or you can write down a potential along which the system runs. This is just to get a picture of the fixed points. It's not in any way to represent the dynamics, okay? So when n is equal to 1, in other words, if it just takes one molecule of TMG binding to one Lac repressor to disable it, then you just get a system with one fixed point, whereas when n is equal to 2, then for some values of these parameters, alpha, beta, and rho, you get a system with two fixed points. Okay? And the fixed point, what that means is you get two stable values of Lac Y expression, or two stable values of GFP expression that the cell will sit at once it's placed there, and a threshold in the middle above which it will run one way or the other. Okay? So, of course, this n is equal to 2 is a necessary condition. It's not sufficient. But it's only for certain values of alpha, beta, and rho that the system actually exhibits this kind of bistability. So this is the entire diagram of the system. So for some values of alpha, beta, and rho, you get a bistable system like this. For other values, you get a monostable system like in the previous slide. So one important point. Three parameters are the minimum you need to describe this kind of behavior. Okay, this is just, we've chosen to parameterize it in this way. You could have written down another, just a cubic with three parameters, and that would have done just as well for saying that there's two fixed points or one fixed point. Okay? The way to check if this model is working is actually to see if these parameters, once we do the experiment, turn out to be biologically meaningful like we saw before, whether alpha really represents maximum activity, whether rho really represents a repression factor that you can measure by independent means. Right? Okay. So, the way we do the experiments is extremely simple. It's sort of 100,000 experiments put together. You just you control the inputs to the system, which is to say extracellular concentrations of the sugar, TMG, and maybe of other things like glucose, other things that feed into the system, which I'm not going to talk about. And you measure the output, which is just fluorescence inside a single cell. So you grow these cells in a beaker in fixed conditions for a fixed amount of time, 24 hours actually, what we chose. And after that amount of time, put them on a microscope slide, just take an image, and then make a histogram of what you see for these cells. So every cell has a certain fluorescence value, and you just plot how many cells have high fluorescence, low fluorescence, and some average. Okay? So this is the protocol. And then you do it again for a different concentration of sugar and maybe a different time of induction. You can change any number of variables you want. Okay? So one thing that comes out of the very general model, so people have known this for a long time, is that when you have these bistable systems, there is the possibility of encoding memory inside the cell. And what that means is, so remember this is TMG running along this axis now, and this is steady state permease concentration along that axis. So very low inducer, you only have a low fixed point, which is a potential looks like this. The very high inducer, you only have a high fixed point, which is a potential that looks like this. But somewhere in the middle, you have these double wells. Okay? So if I start off uninduced, and I increase the TMG concentration, I'll tend to stay uninduced until I reach some kind of threshold, at which point I turn on. But now if I decrease the TMG concentration, I tend to stay induced until I reach some other threshold, at which point I turn off. And what memory means is that in this middle section, in these middle values of TMG, if I were to take a beaker with this TMG value, present it to you, and say, are the cells off or on, you wouldn't know. You would ask me, well, where have they been? What is their history? So in other words, what do they remember? And only then can you tell me. If they started off high, they'll stay high. If they started off low, they'll stay low. That's what memory means. So what we did was just to measure this function. Okay, so here's an example of one of our pictures. So you grow the cells in this particular case, 18 micromolar of TMG. You grow them for 24 hours. You put them on a microscope slide, and you just measure GFP. And here you see these. This is a true, this is sort of phase contrast image with GFP expression on top of it. These cells are about 100 times brighter than the cells that are uninduced. Okay? And it's extremely clear that there's two kinds of cells sitting in this soup. So then what we do is you do the same experiment for different TMG concentrations in exactly the way I said before. You start off uninduced cells, and you move them through different TMG concentrations, going up and going down. And one way to represent all this is just every cell fluorescence value, every dot in this picture is a cell. Okay, so the x-axis over here says what TMG concentration the cell grew up in, right? The y-axis tells you what the fluorescence value inside the cell is. Right? And these two panels are just, do they start off with cells in the off state, or do they start off with the cells in the on state? Right? So you start off with uninduced cells, and you grow them in this concentration of TMG, or this one, and these are exactly the pictures you get after 24 hours. And here you can see very clear hysteresis, right? So these cells stay off over the entire gray range, and eventually they turn on. Whereas if you started with them on, then they stay on over the entire range, and eventually they turn off again. So right here in the middle, right, you can actually take these cells and see how long they tend to stay in these states, one or the other. And the answer turns out to be over 100 generations. Okay? So for over 100 generations, these cells can remember where they came from. One generation time is about 40 minutes in these conditions. Okay, so for days and days and days and days, an induced cell will stay induced, and an uninduced cell will stay uninduced.
I'm wondering how you measure that, because the GFP must be decaying.
So actually, that particular result has been known for exactly 50 years now. I'll tell you how they measured it 50 years ago, single cell measurements. Okay.
What is dashed line?
Sorry, this dashed line tells you the position of that hill in the double well potential, right? So this is the threshold. You start off above this threshold, you tend to go up. You start off below the threshold, you tend to go down. Actually, it's an important point. So you see down here, right? Okay, most of the cells, they started off, they're staying off, but some of them actually went on. Now what's going on is that there's some, of course, there's stochastic fluctuations. Michael talked a lot about this. So some kind of fluctuation will tend to push you over this threshold. Okay, I'm not trying to be quantitative here, I'm just being schematic. And the closer you are to the actual switching threshold, the more easy it is to transition across these states.
So if you heat it up, you can go easier?
Like
if you increase the temperature or something?
If you increase the temperature. So these fluctuations are not thermal fluctuations, they're number fluctuations. And so temperature has very little, temperature is a terrible variable. So if you decrease the number, yes, but it's hard to do it in practice. The question is, can you actually write down a model, including number of fluctuations, that reproduce these results? It's a difficult question, but people try and do it. There's a lot of information here. So one of them is that, yes, okay, as you get closer to the threshold, it's easier to tunnel through. The other one is this GFP hanging around, by the way. Cells that turn on, you see there's this very clear boundary between cells that are hanging around here and cells that are on already. But cells that turn off, you see there's this big smear. And what's going on here is these cells have actually turned off some time ago, and they're just diluting out their GFP. So this is why they're not actually zero. Because the way to get around this would actually be to do experiments like Michael does, where you measure the rate of expression of GFP, in which case you'd see a clear distinction between these cell types. Because there's some cells that don't express, some cells that do express. The expression rate is not correlated, is not precisely given by the fluorescence level of the cell. Yeah?
I'm most likely just completely misunderstanding the experiment, but I mean, are you really doing true hysteresis in the sense that you really walk in a circle, or are you just starting, so to speak, from one side and then independently from the other side?
Okay, so one way to do this experiment would be sort of adiabatically, where you take these guys, you grow them here, then you take these guys and you grow them here, and so on. And eventually you get up here, then you literally walk them back. And we didn't do that because it's a very hard experiment.
Did you try it and it just doesn't work? Or
no, it works, but it just takes much longer. Right? You have to keep culturing this. It works. It works like you would think it does.
Okay. Right?
You can take these cells and put them here, and it does work. But we didn't do it systematically like that. These guys are actually, you just drop them into this concentration and you see what happens. Okay, so reasonable to say that that's not exactly what you should be measuring, but nevertheless, in the middle here, it's a very clear result. And no matter how you do it, you're going to get good separation of history right in the middle. Okay, so the second point that I want to make is that, so here we have this very general diagram. Remember, beta is the TMG level, so if you walk up here, that means you're increasing sugar concentration. Rho is the repression factor, so as you go to the right, you're actually decreasing the repression factor. Okay, so rho is fixed. This cell has a certain repression factor. It's strain dependent, right? You don't change it. So for a given cell, the experiment consists of just moving up along one of these lines. And so for our cell type, clearly we're moving up somewhere here in the diagram, where you start off uninduced, and then a separate induced fixed point occurs, and then that becomes the only fixed point. Right? So our cells transition discontinuously. You'll never find a cell with an intermediate fluorescence level, or at least an intermediate expression level. You'll never find a cell like that. But it is possible, just by changing this repression factor, right, by doing mutations or some other kind of modification, to go to a completely different kind of system where you have only a single fixed point. And here, the way induction happens is that the lac Y level simply changes continuously. From as you increase TMG, the lac Y level increases. Right? So there is positive feedback in the system. It's just not strong enough to give you bistability. So we've seen this also. Yesterday, the strike formation didn't work in some cases because, of course, there is positive feedback in the network, but it's just not strong enough to give you bistability. So can you reproduce this? So yes, you can. The key is to see how you can modify the repression factor. So the repression factor has to do with how, what is the ratio of the off state to the on state of the lac repressor, of the lac operon. And one way to change that is to change the effective concentration of repressor. The less repressor you have, the less tightly you can repress the operon. So what we did was we made three different strains. So this is the wild type. We made two other strains, each one of which contains plasmids with copies of the lac repressor binding site on the plasmid. And so when you add these plasmids to the cell, the repressors bind to those sites and they actually titrate up. So the concentration of repressor drops. And so the repression factor also drops.
What kind of numbers are we talking about?
Of lac repressor. Yeah, so it's something like 5%.
Well, I don't get how you can model this with a continuous...
Well, you can't, right? You can't. If you could have modeled it continuously, you wouldn't have had any of that variability you saw before. So I'm not even claiming you can.
But I mean, isn't that where you've got this graph in the model?
It's not to say that something you learned from this doesn't also apply to the stochastic case, right? So the fixed points of the continuous description correspond to the peaks of the histograms in the stochastic case.
Sometimes.
Very, very often, like unless something strange is going on, that's what
goes on. This is like really a stochastic.
It's very much so. Yeah, I'll get to that. That's really part of where I'm going here. So in fact, that's exactly what's going on. So if you have these, if the model says that you have these double well potentials, it's not that you have all the cells here and none of them over here. You do have some cells that have transitioned across. These stochastic phenomena happen simply because you have low lac repressor, low lac permeance. That's exactly why they happen. I'm not going to get into trying to model those because it doesn't work. Okay, you don't get the right number. Yeah, but it's a very difficult problem. There's all kinds of things changing inside the cell. Like we saw yesterday, just because you know fluctuations in your three genes of interest doesn't mean that you know anything about the real fluctuations going on inside the cell. Something else is going on. Okay, so there's a lot of this extrinsic noise. It's hard to model. But it's there. Okay, so definitely stochastic limit is where we should be thinking about this. So this is just to give an idea of how many fixed points you might expect. So it sort of works, right? So clearly there are histograms with single peaks and histograms with two peaks. So it's not too much of a stretch to say that you've learned something from doing a description like this to start off with. Yeah.
So maybe this is very dumb, but if I were E. coli, my gut feeling would be that I would not want to be bistable.
Okay, so I'll talk about that in just a minute. Well, why would that be your gut feeling?
Because I don't want to get stuck into an on state when the TMG goes away, one thing. The other thing is I don't want to make more lac I than I need to make to suck in the TMG.
Lac Y, that's right, that's right.
Lac-Y.
So for one thing, you don't get stuck onto the on state. There is an off switching threshold. It just happens to be much lower than the on switching threshold. So there is a TMG concentration at which you do turn off.
It just seems to me that if you just follow secondly, analog how much TMG there is,
it's a better
optimal solution.
Secondly, native E. coli growing on lactose is not actually bistable. Right? These histograms actually decay very, very rapidly.
It's not a good solution because you make an investment into switching the...
But you have proteins hanging around already, right? So you want to use them.
So once you've invested in making like Y and like Z, you don't want to switch to another substrate. You'll try to keep on using the same substrate even if it's is lower than
because you already have these proteins created and they are doing their job. So you want to squeeze everything you can out of your current investment. It's a reasonable model.
Think about like if you're fluctuating right on the boundary where the bistability would be, then you have to keep switching. If there's a no hysteresis, the hysteresis band were really narrow, you just keep switching modes.
Sorry, you would just make very few. I mean,
you can do a little economic analysis.
You can, people do, yet it's important to point out this is not what happens in real cells with lactose.
Yeah, the point of the thing is with lactose you have a feedback loop in the circuit, right? I mean...
No, with both these you have feedback loop in the circuit.
Well, with TMG is called with feedback.
Right.
With lactose the other way around.
No, it isn't.
So what is breaking down like differently, really?
The problem with lactose is that, this is a trade secret. When lactose...
The enzyme is breaking down lactose, but it's not breaking down TMG.
Exactly. So when lactose gets into the cell, then not only is lac-Y expressed, lac-Z is expressed, which is the enzyme that converts lactose to allolactose and then to glucose fructose and then to glycolysis. But if you increase the expression of the lac operon, you don't necessarily increase the concentration of the inducer. You do, it's very weak. Okay, so it's more like this regime where there is positive feedback, but it's very weak. So I'll talk about this later. Now, there's a lot of detail when you look at other inducers. But remember, what I started off with was not that I want to know how cells deal with lactose. I was saying I want to know how positive feedback works in a small reactor with small molecule numbers in living cells. Right? So then allow me that thing of using TMG and seeing how these things work. But you're completely right. It's not clear what the strategy should be, but I'll get into that in the second half of the talk. But look, I just finish off with this picture. I really like it. Look, here you have these cells where you increase this number here is TMG concentration in micromolar. So if you increase the TMG concentration, what happens is that cells are off or on, and what's happening is that the fraction of cells that are on is what's increasing. Whereas in this string, as you increase TMG, it's really the mean value in each cell.
What is the stuff in the middle? Like you got Gaussians there. You just said that these are all or nothing.
So which stuff in the middle, sorry?
I thought you said that
here,
the switch is
here.
Supposed to be pretty much. I mean, your graph before was a log scale where you had things.
Yeah, this is also a log scale. This is also a log scale right here. So these guys are all basically off plus autofluorescence.
They're like around 5. And those are
precisely. Right. They're all off, but you cannot remove autofluorescence, which is why there's any width at all. But if you do remove autofluorescence, it works out quite nicely. The numbers work out with the variance and all that. It works. Okay, good. So just to finish off with this, I just want to walk you around here. You can go from off to on, either just continuously or discontinuously. And so somewhere in here, there's a critical point. So you can rope in like that. Okay, so this is nice. It works just by changing this very specific variable. So now, this is the key to it, right? So what the hell is going on? So if you have all these cells, I just want to show you a time course of how you get to this state. If you start off with all the cells in the off state, and then you grow them, you have shown for 10 hours, we actually did it for 20 or 24 hours. This is a different log scale, this is a different microscope, okay? So pay no attention to the numbers here, but it's still a log scale. Look, within a half hour, actually, some cells start turning on expression of GFP. Full expression. I mean, the rate of expression is the maximum level of expression of the operon. After 8 or 9 hours, some cells still haven't turned on. These are not dead cells. Right? These are living, these are alive, and eventually they will switch on. Okay, but there's this huge discrepancy as to when they turn on. And one measurement you could do, we haven't done it, is to again grow the cells, measure the rate of GFP expression, deduce the initial concentration of permease that's inside the cell by measuring uptake rate. So this measurement has been done.
Do you know that they didn't turn off already?
Yes, because this is in a case where you never see cells turn off from the other side. Okay, so these cells are not the kind that do turn off over the time scale of our experiments.
Okay.
So that's how you know that. But look, so why is it that these cells turned on? What's happening is that those cells were expressing permease to begin with. Okay, that's the only way. Enough permease to take up TMG, to de-repress the operon, and start expressing. These cells still are not expressing permease. If they were, they would have started to turn on. So there's a huge variation in expression. The mechanisms of this, how you can explain this variability quantitatively, it's difficult. Okay, but in principle, we can do it. It has to do with fluctuations inside the cell. Okay, so now I want to get into whether the cell actually knows that it's living in this crazy kind of environment, whether it, yeah?
I'm just curious, I mean, these it's kind of hard to see these blobs on this histogram.
Yeah.
What is the density versus...
Yeah, but actually, I've put the same number of dots in all the, I put the same number of spots in each of these things. So they're all normalized histograms.
Right, but I'm just curious, you said it was the last one at time 9, so how much mass is in the head and how much?
This is something like 5% here. Yeah. It's very, very dense, very, very dense. I mean, what I really should do is plot a histogram.
Right.
Okay, I can give you the histogram. Okay, so somewhere here it's about halfway. Okay, so let's talk about anticipation. This is what I want to get into. So this is what led me to start thinking about. So these cells are now going to be grown, if you think about the wild type, they're going to be grown in lactose. So there is no positive feedback, but actually you can do the experiment with lactose, you get a similar kind of transient. You get some cells that take a long time to turn on, although eventually you never get bimodal. So look, these cells are not anticipating well at all, in the sense that, you know, some of them have got it right, some of them have got it wrong, and this is maybe not how you would design a system if you were an engineer. So how, you know, what does a cell do when it needs to switch between a resource that has been depleted and whatever's coming next? Right? So the question is, what is coming next? So I think this is really fundamental when we start talking about free living cells. The kinds of talks we've been hearing with eukaryotic cells, with programs, you know, there's a certain number of programs they can execute, the kind of signals they get are very well defined. Either they're cells that are supposed to be neurons, so they develop in a certain way, or they're supposed to be other kinds. So in fact, the way we study free living cells in the lab is very much like the way cells in multicellular organisms sit, right? So the conditions are not time invariant, the conditions are sort of well defined. There's a certain set of conditions you might encounter. There's a dominant set of stimulants and signals that you're going to learn to deal with, right? And more or less a small number of non-housekeeping genes are going to be used during this process. So when the cell is growing on glucose, right, it's using only the glucose metabolic genes, and all kinds of other genes have turned off. Right? So this is how we study cells. So this is the little experimental carrot, and the cell is just going on with your game. Now what really happens is that these cells are sitting in, they're generalists, right? They've evolved, they're growing in all kinds of conditions. Right? They have literally hundreds of different metabolic capabilities, only a few of which we explore in the lab, and definitely only one at a time do we explore in the lab. These environments are uncertain, they're time varying, huge number, therefore the number of genes that you really need to deal with for an uncertain future is all your genes. You have all these guys to deal with whatever comes next. So how does it distribute expression between all these things? Yeah.
So is this something you actually know, or this is just your gut?
No, so this is the, like I said, this is the anticipation part of my project, right? So this is gut feeling, I'm going to do experiments to check all this. Right, so this is
maybe in my gut, right, it's not so variable at all.
It's, it is. There are time variations depending on your time since you've eaten and things like that. And secondly, they're not only in your gut, they actually colonize your kidney and other surfaces. And they actually, they cycle through your body, so they don't just live there, they leave. And right. They spend a lot of time outside and they come back in.
So when they're in the gutter, right? Or
yeah.
In the sewerage.
Yeah.
So, I have no clue if it's very
blood sugar. Precisely, but definitely it's not well-defined glucose meaning. That's all my point is. And yeah. And sewers are not uniform lab conditions. Different sewers look different. But the same cell grows in different sewers. Okay, what is the best way to grow in? Yeah.
Okay, just before you proceed to the second part of the talk, but so you may not understand precisely the kinetics and dynamics of the reactions in a single cell that turn its decision to switch.
Mm-hmm.
But on a phenomenological level,
mm-hmm.
you can try and figure out what's triggering the switch, meaning what explains the variance in the decision to switch. So
right.
I mean, there's some decision, the decision-making models, right, where it's basically like a diffusive random walk.
Phenomenologically, we understand everything.
So that all the variances can. No, what do you mean understand? I mean, there are different models for decision making. There's models which are diffuse random models with some bias, and then right. So which model is it? What does it fit? What is the underlying process?
Look, so diffusive random walk, where diffusion comes from number fluctuations of molecules, pretty much explains everything we need to know if you feed the numbers in.
Fluctuation of what concentration?
Of all concentrations.
It's integrating the amount of glucose it's seeing, and then it makes a decision.
No. So you cannot talk about it in those terms. It's not a computer decision-making machine with very simple integrators. It's just a whole soup.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is, it's not a useful enterprise to try and push that to the very limit where you can predict the switching state in this TMG concentration. You won't be able to do it. We've tried.
Mm-hmm.
But the signs work out correctly, right? As you change the numbers involved, switching rates increase.
Sure.
Right? And the signs work out correctly as you add inducers, switching rates increase.
I really don't see, I think you have a nice set of experiments that show a process that we kind of hope would be true, and that would be our intuition
right.
what happened.
Right.
But I don't see how the quantitative model
Oh, yeah, fine. So I didn't get into this, but like I said, there's these three parameters you can actually fit. Okay, so let me, okay, for the 5-minute break. So you have this hysteretic curve, right, from which you can operationally define what the switching thresholds are. But at the threshold, there's actually three equations, three unknowns. You can just fit the parameters. Whatever these parameters mean, we don't know what they mean. They're just three parameters, which is what you need to fit a threshold-like phenomenon. So you fit them, and then what we did was we actually had several other kinds of conditions. So you add glucose and you change other parameters, you add these plasmids, you change it, so you sweep over all experimentally available parameters, and you fit these three things that come out of your model. Okay, then you go back and check whether what you got really reproduces what people have been measuring in experiments for the last 50 years, and it does spot on.
That's just extraordinary to me that you could take a not continuous system in the slightest. You're talking about five molecules in the cell.
But what
continuously?
But the key for the continuous, right?
Completely predictive.
But the point is that the only thing we take out of the model is not the dynamics, but the fixed points, which transfer very easily between continuous and discontinuous in these kinds of systems. Right? So if you deal with only the fixed points, which is exactly what I'm saying, if you only look at fluorescence values and not anything else, right, that's the key to this thing. So that's why it worked. It's not something that's generalizable. It works for this system, but it works remarkably well.
Is there a reason why the fixed point is able to transfer so well?
Yes, I mean, you can write down, so what happens is that these potentials that I was drawing aren't fictitious. Actually, if it was a one-variable system, then these potentials actually look like energy potentials, and you're talking about diffusion in these potentials, and then the minima of the potentials correspond to the maxima of the probability distribution in steady state. You know, you can go through all the math and it works out. Yeah?
I have another insane question about the first one.
Sure.
Which is, did you check that by introducing the second promoter into the cell, you didn't disturb the original
yes.
one?
Yes. Yeah, so you do.
How do you do that?
No. You do disturb. So actually, we added, you check it precisely by doing the experiment with plasmids that contain multiple promoter copies. And you see how much it disturbs the system. Okay? So, unfortunately, the promoter does disturb the system. But again,
how much is it?
Adding one extra promoter has almost no discernible drop in the repression factor that we can measure, okay? That's not to say that it's not measurable. To make a direct measurement of repression factor actually involves looking at uninduced cells and induced cells. So you're looking at autofluorescence, which then comes, you're talking about a factor of 1,000 repression, compared to autofluorescence, so it's hard to pull out the number. So in fact, the repression factor we measured is about 100, not 1,000. That's because off cells still have some fluorescence.
Sorry, now I'm confused. I mean, you want, but that's the disturbance precisely that you want. Right?
At the end, yes. The disturbance you mean to add other promoters and
yes.
To, yeah. So adding one, so the statement is adding one promoter makes little difference. We have to add 10 or 50 promoters to make a difference.
Right. And these things, they transcribe some
transcripts? No, they don't transcribe. No, they don't transcribe. They're just promoter copies. And they're just repressive binding type copies.
Yes. Okay, very good.
But they don't transcribe anything at all.
Okay, so they do what you want them to do.
They do what you want them to do. You can plot that curve as a function of plasmid number, you can plot the repression factor, and then for the large numbers it sort of works out. The small numbers is difficult to measure.
Five molecules of this lac repressor, and yet adding more copies of lac repressor isn't affecting how well it represses the...
It does. Like I said, adding one doesn't, and adding 50 does.
No, I understand that, but I guess that's just counterintuitive to me.
But again, this was related to a question we had before. These repressors don't just stick forever. They're in equilibrium. Right?
So the fact that it doesn't throw it in half when you add one.
No, it doesn't throw it in half.
Has something to do with the fact that the other one sits on a long DNA and it's maybe sliding along it?
No, it has to do with a fraction of the time a given repressor molecule spends on the DNA.
Right, but I would say if there are two promoters in the whole cell versus one, you know, the time should be half-half unless this thing likes to sit
on the electron. Not at all. As long as the same repressor, it's for a given promoter, the repressor has a certain amount of hit for it. If you're not saturating, right, there's this KD repressive dissociation constant, right? So if you don't have too much concentration of DNA sites, right, you won't make any difference to this equilibrium. But you can add 2, 3, 4, and as long as these rates are sufficiently biased towards being off,
because the lac repressor binding sites are as far as I remember, extremely sparse in the genome. It's one of these cases where you have really few binding sites, and you would think there must be a reason for that.
Oh. Yeah, but you're saying it does make a difference.
Yes.
And look, the reason, well, I'm glad you asked that. So look, we don't know what the effective number of binding sites of lac repressor on the DNA is. Okay, we've increased that by one. And your question is that really making a difference?
Well, there has been a lot of, there's been a couple of different papers out that
but
show that the effective number is extraordinarily small.
It is small. It is small. And we've increased it by one. And I'm saying, operationally, experimentally, to our resolution, that doesn't make a difference. To the binding fraction, binding time on this particular promoter we're interested in.
I mean, the question is sort of if this promoter, which is, you stick it into some region of the chromosome, if that would do exactly the same as the original one, right? So did you flip the promoters?
Yeah.
I mean, the whole promoter plus gene?
We actually added another promoter that has similar effect and then measured it against this, and there was no position-dependent effect, right? So, yes, we did a few checks.
It is sort of interesting.
It is interesting from a sort of biochemical point of view as to how many promoters you can add.
What's your intuition about how this is working? Are you saying that you have this repressor that...
Wait, this is a simple problem, right? So, look, the effective cytoplasmic concentration of repressor is the correct variable to think about because that's what determines how fast something jumps onto your promoter. No matter how many are bound to other promoters, okay? So if they spend sufficiently small amounts of time on other promoters, then adding many of those will not change the effective cytoplasmic concentration of repressor. And I'm telling you that's the regime we're in.
But then you're also saying that it's spending a very small amount of time on your promoter.
Of course it is.
So they're whizzing on and off.
They are. That's what equilibrium means.
I don't understand that, but the question is, how does transcription...
Okay, fine, so you can figure this out. The transcription, then it has to do with only when it's free, does the polymerase have time to bind, and when it's bound, it doesn't, and so it changes the effective binding rate of polymerase to your promoter, and so it changes...
So do you know what the time, the free...
Yeah, I don't know it offhand, but, you know, it's been very well measured.
It's been well measured, how much free time...
The equilibration time for the lac repressor is extremely rapid.
I guess what everybody's sort of trying to ask for 10 minutes is if your data indicates that the amount of time that lac I spends on the plasmid promoter that you throw in is the same as it spends on your main promoter or not.
Yeah, I would guess it is. Okay, so I don't know.
Okay, so the question is your small reduction rate consistent with that assumption? Or do you have to assume that...
No, that's what I'm saying, it's consistent. No, it's consistent. For large plasmid numbers, I'm saying it's consistent. Numerically consistent. For the small, adding one extra promoter, we can't measure it because there's other binding to DNA and there's this autofluorescence problem that we have to measure. For large promoter numbers, it's completely consistent with the known off and on rates. It's a very simple statement. It's correct. So this is not such a...
I don't think we're arguing with you.
I'm saying that it's equilibration.
Like you can give me a source where I can read about it.
Yeah, there's 50 years of sources on these rates. Wow. I'll give you any number of them. In fact, search for anything by Magasanic, you'll get any number of papers measuring your quantity.
Magasanic?
This is 1967 paper, by the way.
Great.
All
right.
Any number of papers where these people have been measuring these rates for a long time. Biochemistry, not
just
a single cell.
Just one final question. I may not be understood. I just don't understand your statement that the disrepressor is bound, right, to provide a small amount of time to promote it, because then it would mean that it represses promoter very inefficiently, right?
No, it has to do with the fraction of time it's bound is the efficiency of repression, not the amount of time it's bound.
There's two time scales, right? How long it takes to start transcription and how long it takes how often your transcription repressor is sitting on your...
If the off and on rates of the repressor are sufficiently fast that many of them happen between independent bindings of the polymerase, then we're fine. That's the regime we're in.
It's not entirely clear to me. So you have the fraction of time you spend on the promoter is just the relative ratio of the on and off rate,
correct. Right? Correct.
Okay. But then there is this absolute value of the on and off rate. So either it goes on very infrequently and it stays there for a long time, or it goes on very frequently, goes off very frequently. And which of the two is more effective in repressing? It's not done.
No.
Sure, repression is controlled by the probability of the site being occupied, right? And that has nothing to do with on-off rate, right? It can be occupied.
Not entirely clear, right? Because maybe the polymerase is pushing, it's just waiting for this fraction of time to be able to push through when this thing goes off. Maybe it doesn't depend at all.
It's an interesting, so we can get into it. But it's more or less the accepted model of how these things work. It's an interesting question as to, you know, how long does the promoter need to clear before the polymerase is able to find it, recognize it, push another protein out of the way, get ATP and begin transcription before the repressor comes and knocks it off.
Not even the case either, right? It could very well be that your polymerase gets on the DNA and then now the repressor has no place to find it.
I completely agree. So if this had been a talk about transcription, I would have talked a lot about this. But again, I can give you references and we can talk about this offline. Okay, this is very, very tangential topic and not even interesting in my opinion. So, because it sort of works. It's a good model. It's a good biophysical model. People have done single molecule experiments, and so people are working on it. Okay, so anyway, so we can actually start talking about this after this is finished, because this is a very short part of the talk, so there will be time when we're done, and you can just grill me again, and I'll try and get back to that. So these experiments are from 60s. This is E. coli. This is E. coli with constitutive expression of LacY. Okay. This is E. coli grown in a mixture of glucose and lactose, glucose and maltose, and these are cell densities, log scale. This is time, right? So just consider this case. So you have cells that are growing exponentially, and then there's this sort of 30 or 45 minute lag, and then they grow exponentially again. So this again has been known for about 75 years, and what's happening here is that cells that are growing in glucose don't even try and metabolize lactose. The lac operon is repressed by a protein called CRP, and I won't talk about that. So once the glucose runs out, which is here, because they're actually using up the glucose in the beaker, then there's this lag, which was interpreted as the cells are retooling, and they're producing lactamase and all kinds of things, and eventually they're able to live on lactose. Whereas if you're expressing LacY all the time, you're okay. Okay? So also, this is glucose lactose at a different concentration, same kind of behavior. This is glucose maltose. You see that this lag phase occurs again, and it's independent in the two strains because maltose doesn't need lac-y for its expression, for its uptake.
So when you were to plot these on top of each other, who would be winning?
Who would be winning? You mean between this cell and this cell?
Yeah.
Good question. So actually, it would be this cell would win out, probably, because it depends how much lac-y you're actually making. Whether it's large enough that it's the dominant source that impacts growth rate, but I would guess that this cell wins out.
Right.
But the cell that's on all the time wins out.
What is dioxy?
Okay, dioxy means dual growth. Two growths. So there's two growth phases separated by a lag phase.
Okay.
Coined by a Frenchman, so you know. This is coined by Jacques Monod. This is coined by Jacques Monod. Okay, so.
Fair
enough. So, you like the coin word.
Fair
enough. So, and this is a good one. See, what he was doing, just think about the experiment this guy was doing. He was a graduate student. He was growing these cells, and somebody had asked him to measure growth rates of E. coli in 100 different kinds of environments. And what a boring thing to do. And he was sitting there just making these plots and measuring the slopes of these curves on a log-Lin scale, and suddenly he found this happening and went off and got a Nobel Prize. It's just a completely amazing story. So, I love these guys. Okay, so the question is what's happening over here. Okay, and I'm going to give you two possible interpretations for that. So, we do this experiment in single cells, except that we do it in succinate and lactose in different sugar, under which condition the lag phase is actually not pronounced. Okay, so I don't actually have data for glucose lactose. These guys are fluorescence values, lac operon expression in single cells. As you go through this growth. So here you have the glucose growth phase, so you have the lactose growth phase, the succinate growth phase, so you have the lactose growth phase with a slightly different slope. And over here you can convince yourself there's a little bit of lag between them. So what's actually happening, the reason you don't completely switch to the second growth rate immediately is that some fraction of your cells are not growing when the succinate runs out. Okay, it's only these cells that have turned on the operon that are growing. These cells that don't have the operon on are not growing. Okay, you never.
They're not growing, or they're still eating a little bit.
They're still eating a little bit of succinate. They're growing much more slowly, much more slowly. Okay, so why do you have a lag? It's not that all the cells sit, put up their feet for 20 minutes and just wait. Okay, some cells switch on and they start growing immediately. But you just don't see them because they're not a huge fraction of the population until they become dominant, and then.
Wait, so you're saying that lag has nothing to do with the translation lag?
20 minutes, 10 minutes of that perhaps, right? But not 50 minutes of lag.
Wait, so lag is actually.
Lag can be up to 1 hour. Up to 1 hour. There's no way you can explain that by translation lag or any other kind of protein synthesis. So this is really what's happening. You can see this in the lactose system. I don't have the picture for glucose lactose deoxy, but this is really what happens. And it's not crazy if you consider what I showed you about lac permease expressing cells. Some cells were expressing permease to begin with. Right? They're sucking up the lactose and growing immediately, whereas others were not. Right? And by the way, this has very little to do with the positive feedback part of the story. This has to do with the completely non-uniform distribution of permease in these cells. Right? This cell was expressing permease to begin with, and he grows. These guys were not. I mean, some of them might turn on later, but it's a little too late. These are the guys who dominate the population. So the growth rate switches between the white rate and sort of the green rate slowly, only because these guys only take this much time to become the dominant fraction of the population. But the individual cells, the lag is, I'm going to try and measure this, but the lag is not accounted for by how long it takes a single cell to switch.
But on your graph, you said this is like 30 minutes?
It completely depends on the condition, which two sugars.
But at 30 minutes, that's one cell cycle, right?
So a cell cycle can be anywhere between 40 minutes and an hour and a half, but yes.
Not even one cell cycle?
Yes.
So why is this a discontinuous process?
Cell cycle in glucose is 20 minutes, but the lag phase can be up to an hour depending on what other sugar you're going to. So several cell cycles.
Okay.
No, but I mean, you said you were just doing that for a 30-minute lab, right? That was what your graph just said, right?
Yeah.
Well, okay, so
this is about a 45-minute lag, yeah. That's a little bit longer.
One cell cycle?
No, several cell cycles depending on the initial sugar. But yes, on order of a single cell cycle.
But you're not growing on glucose at that point, right?
You've run out of glucose, that's right. So these cells are not...
So now the cell cycle should be...
Well, you can see what a cell cycle is. It's the same, well, it's sort of the slope of this curve. You can work out exactly what the cell doubling time is in this system. So 40 to 80
I guess in
50 minutes. So the cell cycle is, yeah, so it's about one cell cycle.
Why does it look like this as opposed to just some kind of curve?
It is some kind of curve. On a log-log plot, it looks very much like this, but I'm sure you'll see some curvature over there when you're done. If you add an exponential to a flat line and then plot it in a log-log plot, you'll see a straight line and another straight line.
Well, I guess there is... This thing, it looks much more flatter than your curve, right? So it sort of suggests that there's not that much variance in the population.
What about that? Or this, for that matter. So it's hard to say, but I agree. So this is something that I'm saying is worth exploring, because in the case I know for lack, individual cells switch on very, very soon. And they start growing. This is experimental fact.
So somehow Mr. Jacot's cells had less heterogeneity than yours.
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying that even these guys did have the heterogeneity. I'm saying that that's precisely why there is this lag. It's a slight reinterpretation of lag. I'm saying that all these cells are certainly not behaving the same way. They're not waiting for 1 hour. I've never seen a cell sit and wait for 1 hour and suddenly start to grow all of them at the same time. Never seen that happen.
But within one or two cell cycles, those cells are growing, can't dominate the
population. It depends on the fraction, but yeah. It depends. It depends on the time scales and the rates and so on. So the question is, how can 1/100th of the cells suddenly start coming up? So, and it's a real question of what the fractions are and how fast they tend to grow and so on, right? But the.
But I thought we just learned that, right?
Look, one cell cycle is exactly how much time you would expect to go from sort of flat growth to exponential growth when you add it to a constant on the order of a cell cycle. One. Two cell cycles, something like that. The rest of the cells are not growing.
So what fraction of the cells are growing?
That's unknown.
So
the consistent picture would be the lag is 1 hour, so that's 3 cell cycles, so that's a factor of 8.
Yes.
So 10% of cells.
10% of cells. 10% of cells.
Kick in and off they go.
Which is not—it's not inconsistent with this. And certainly the variability is there in the system at known. So now I want to ask this economic question as to why you would even operate like this.
It's a little too flat.
It is a little too flat. But there is definitely a lag. There's definitely a lag when...
Okay.
There's definitely the translational lag. Okay? Cells do take some finite amount of time to switch.
Maybe Jacot fixes results.
It's only too flat by 1 point.
These people don't look. This curve actually goes down. I mean, there are no error bars on this. Anyway, it is fairly flat. I mean, this guy's not flat. Right? This guy's not flat.
Yeah.
Right? So this is completely on.
No, it's too flat. Well,
it's too flat, but you have to remember that somebody picked that curve out of.
Yeah. No. I've said if you actually measure these curves yourself in the lab, you don't get them very flat. You don't get them. So this is like the standard like first year undergrad bio experiment. And people, I think they get penalized for not getting flat curves. So then that's what you learn as a biologist over the years. Sorry, for all biologists, hear this, because I'm being recorded. But anyway, not inconsistent. I'm just saying the slight reinterpretation of an old picture. Okay, but this is true. This I've seen this happen. Is that some cells take turn on very, very quickly. So the question is why you'd want to do this and why you'd really want to have only a small fraction of your cells respond to growth, right, to the new sugar. And the answer is that you don't know what the new sugar is going to be. Right? Let's not just talk about sugars, but everything else that the cell can take up, that needs a permease to take up. There's over 200 different transporters that E. coli encodes. There's only 250 transporters that the cell encodes. But it needs these to pump in these nutrients across the cell membrane. Right? To anticipate something or to commit to some metabolic state is to say you've expressed that permease. That's the first step in commitment. Right? These cells that have just been growing glucose, they don't know that lactose is coming next in this experiment and that maltose is coming next in that experiment. Right? Or not to mention like the 50 other sugars that are, you know, 20 other sugars that it can take up.
Then you're saying that the sensible E. coli will know the probability of this or that.
I'm sure it does. Sure it does.
You mean it doesn't, this isn't... Okay, I mean, you could imagine that you have a bunch of cells that have one... You're saying that even add one or two permeases, whatever, it's just...
No, I'm not saying that. So then, of course, it's a question of numbers. Of course,
why not just put a couple in there and
I agree.
If lactose shows up, great, you go. If it doesn't,
I agree. So that's this model of expression where you sort of have maybe 10 dominant nutrients that you more or less get most of the time when this kind of thing happens. So you express all of them, in this case 4, all of them in small amounts. Okay? Remember, the sum of these concentrations, this is all futile expression, mostly. Right? The sum of these concentrations should be small compared to your total protein load, or it's going to impact the slope of that curve, and that's a big deal. Okay, you don't want to impact the slope of that curve. Your job is E. coli to try and minimize futile expression because you want to go fast. That's what these cells do.
Maybe a better way to say this is that one of the reasons you wouldn't want to have all your cells go at the same time into lactose is that it's not that you don't know what's coming next. It's that you don't know if you have a tidbit of lactose or a ton of lactose. You don't want to commit all your
cells. You definitely don't want to commit, but you don't even know if it's lactose.
No, but you don't commit at all if it's not lactose, even if in this case.
No, the question is, do you anticipate lactose or do you anticipate maltose?
Or everything. Or are you just waiting for everything?
No, but the point is, that this picture, you're anticipating everything, and if whatever shows up, it's not like you're doing anything.
No, I agree. So the question is, why is this bad? And I'll get into that. Why would you not want this? Okay. So these are two extremes. Obviously, the correct thing lies somewhere in the middle. Okay. You express everything in small doses, so the total concentration is low enough you can deal with it. Or you express that total in completely different packages in different cells.
What's Q?
Q is the number of different sugars that you generally try and pick up. Okay, there's 10 different sugars that more or less most of the time you're waiting for. Okay. Yeah.
There also, I mean, this homogeneous thing, and I thought always that lactose is actually something the bacteria don't really like. I mean, there's some biochemistry about which...
Correct, which sugars they prefer. So obviously the distribution is going to... Well, so in this case, the fraction of cells or the distribution of things has to do with preference and probability of occurrence,
right,
and all kinds of things. But those are kinds of questions I want to get into. I don't have anything to say about it, but it's very interesting. Like, can you reveal preferences based on expression levels and sort of anticipating strategies and such things? I agree. So, but with sugars, there's a preference hierarchy of sugar. You would rather wait a little while longer for something better to come along. So, hard to put numbers on this thing. But two crazy extremes, but let's just see what that means. So in this case, all your cells are capable of taking up the sugar when it comes along. Okay? And in this case, only 1 over Q, where Q is the number of different permeases you're expressing, only 1 over Q cells are waiting. Now, this is a very important quantity. Okay? This quantity says when you've dedicated all your surplus resources to producing that one permease, this is the response time in the single cell. Okay? So this is sort of measuring the amount you're willing to expend on futile permease production. Okay? The more you're willing to expend, the less this time you'll get. Okay? Now, in this very, very baby model, what I'm saying is, okay, you have one Q the stuff, so it's going to take you 2 times as long. But it's not very important what function it is. Okay? So if it takes you 1 minute to respond with all your permease doing one thing, maybe it'll take you 10 minutes if you have 1/10 of that permease. Okay? Not unreasonable, but it's not necessarily going to be that good.
Why would they think this is linear?
It's not. I'm just saying it doesn't really matter what it is. This is just for the purposes of my making a case here. You can replace this with anything you want. Any kind of weak dependence on this. It's certainly going to take more time. Okay, if you have less stuff, it'll take more time.
Well,
especially
my intuition would have been that that's not the case. That if you had 2 permeases versus 10, you start some autocatalytic feedback cycle that you just go.
Oh, no, no. The question is precisely when you get into the autocatalytic part of the feedback cycle, and it's very strongly dependent on permeation number. Very strongly dependent.
But it's not dependent on time. It's dependent on the number of
permeases. Precisely. So the number of permeases sets the time to reach a threshold intracellular inducer concentration, at which point your autocatalysis becomes efficient. It's very sharp. You wait a long time and then you kick in. And that amount of time is strongly dependent on the initial permease concentration.
Unless you had some internal amplifier or something.
Even then, if you had an amplifier, then you get into this question of hair trigger and all that. But even then, you will find a certain amount of lag and then a kick in.
Yeah.
But no matter how you parse this, it won't be this simple function.
Okay.
But, let's just finish this graph and then we can argue about that. There's two cases. There's homogeneous is this dark blue and heterogeneous is light blue. Here we have the same kind of curve, which is cell density is a function of time. And in the homogeneous case, all your cells are ready to go, right? But they take a long time to go. And in the heterogeneous case, it's only one fraction, but they take much less time, okay? And then they go. And the question is, does this curve really lie above this curve, which is to say, is this quantity really shorter than this quantity?
That's this total opposite of what my intuition would be about what's going on here, right? Is that it should have nothing. My intuition is it has nothing to do with time.
That's not true at all.
I understand that you want to have some threshold where you do or don't respond to lactose.
Let's start with a very simple model where you just have, there's no positive feedback. You just need some amount of sugar inside the cell before you can grow, and you express permease.
But we're mixing two different decisions, right? One decision is do I want to? Is there enough lactose in the environment to go? Okay.
That's true. That's another level of complex. Here I'm saying that there's lots of lactose.
But you're saying the trade-off between having extra permeases is how fast I'm able to detect how much lactose is in the environment.
If there is enough lactose. Given that, the question is, how fast do you gear up and go?
I understand, but my intuition would be that time difference is trivial. The reason that you would do
it's
something
not,
like this
it's not.
Is that you don't
it's not at all trivial. It's precisely.
You don't want to commit to lactose for all your cells.
No, that is true too, but that time difference
I'll tell you precisely the case in which it is not trivial. It's the case in which you have such few permeases you're playing with. You're talking about the difference between 1 and 10. Because really these numbers are small. This is a futile expression. And there is really where it makes a difference. Okay, so you could write down more realistic models. And so if you're talking about 1,000 permeases or 2,000 permeases, there's no difference in time. None. But that's not what the cell is doing. It's a futile expression. We're talking about 10 permeases or 1. And there it really makes a difference. One permease takes a long time for an autocatalytic cycle to start up.
You're making the assumption that I'm going to make this an active process, right? To say somebody engineered this cell. You have some network. You're saying that it wasn't smart enough to amplify the signal in the right
way. No, but it doesn't. It takes time. No matter how clever you are as an engineer, it takes time to begin the amplification cycle from low expression numbers. That's the whole key. The key is you start off with low numbers, how quickly can you gear up? If you start off with high numbers, you can gear up instantaneously. We saw that already. Lack-like constitutive, you start going boom. Start off with low numbers, how quickly can you gear up? And you write down any model, it'll...
So you're saying that the cell, your argument is that the cell, in order to be in that case, would have to expend a lot of energy by making 10 permeases.
By making 100 or 1,000, right?
You just said 1 versus 10.
Well, 1 versus 10 is precisely where we're at, yes. And it's not a lot of energy. You don't want to spend a lot of energy.
Okay, but you're saying the time lag is all in making of the permeases.
No. It's also in sensing, autocatalysis, reaching some threshold. It could be any number of things.
That's the question, right?
The question is if there's such a big, huge difference between 1 and 10, why not just have 10?
No, but then
that's precisely the point. You have to have 10 of everything. You have to have 100. You have to have 10 of maltose, lactose, mannose, fructose, everything. That's precise. Okay, thank you for asking the question. Precisely the question. So here's the heterogeneous strategy. Here's the homogeneous strategy. Now, I agree that you have a lot of permease, which is to say your response time is very low. Right? This heterogeneous strategy is preferred. It's exactly what your intuition says. When it doesn't matter how much permease you make, of course you make everything. Okay? But suppose you're in this region, right? You're willing to only expend a certain amount of permease. You're going to go for the heterogeneous strategy. One final way to say this. Suppose I constrain the cell. Say you cannot be heterogeneous. You must be homogeneous. Right? how much more permeas do you need to make in order to get the same response time? The answer will be some factor of 10 or 50 or something like that, right? If you start off here, you need to make a lot more permeas to get the same response.
But there's one more time step. You didn't finish the cycle yet, right? Because the heterogeneous population, you pick the one that's expressing the right thing, it expands. But that guy now has to go and make a new heterogeneous population from the homogeneous population.
No. Very good question.
Explain this again, I missed what you said.
Sure. So that's why I wanted to say, so this T0 is a measure of how fast the cell can gear up, given that it has committed as much as it's willing to commit to one permease.
Okay.
So this is some time scale, maybe it's 20 minutes,
yeah.
Okay, whatever. If T0 is very high, that means it's not even willing to spend much permease. It's taking a long time to commit. If you push it to below, by the way, this number is of order 1. So if you push it to below 1 cell size, if you're committed enough that you're able to gear up from 0 to 60 in one cell cycle, right, then T0 is low. Okay, so this is the high permease regime, this is the low permease regime. Okay, so this curve just says that these are the two strategies, and of course you're going to pick one that gives the lowest response time.
How did you get the formula in those curves? I thought we just said we didn't know what the formula is.
No, this one we know what the formula is. It's exactly the time to respond plus the time it takes for the population to come to dominate. This one is just that it's something larger than T0. Right? I've said linear, it could be anything, and you'll still get this kind of behavior.
So they could be right next to each other.
If this is not an assumption, if they're right next to each other, you're right. They're right next to each other.
I don't understand. If we don't know the form of how the permease is different, how the trigger relates to the amount of lactose coming in relative to the permease.
I'll follow that up after the talk. But I'm telling you that this relationship at this time is much larger than this time is generic. You have to believe me. I'll prove it to you later.
Unless the time is large, but it isn't exactly.
Your question is, you know, how reasonable is it to expect that this time is so much larger than this? And I'm telling you, it's very reasonable in the case that your initial time is very large to begin with.
What is the main reason why there is such a substantial lifetime difference?
It's because suppose you plot as a function of time intracellular inducer in an autocatalytic cycle, when you tend to get one of these curves that takes off after a lag. You can define the lag however much you want. That lag is often quadratically or even exponentially dependent on the initial permease concentration. We can write down a model.
We have an unstable fixed point.
Okay.
So the question is, how fast do you get out of a stable fixed point?
But you're being pushed
out. No. But very, you're very close to it.
It's linear
stability.
But if you're zero, you're zero.
Exactly.
But the limit where you say one TMG molecule, you know, getting through the transporter, just starts churning out the.
But I want to put your money where your snap is, and just write down a model where it turns on immediately and there's enough inducer for
the cell
to start going.
There's an amplifier that if it has this hair trigger, if it feels anything...
Whatever you do, you'll get lag. And that lag will be dependent on the permease concentration. I agree the lag can be put extremely close to zero. In which case, you're here. In which case, I agree with all of you that the standard strategy is the right thing to do. But that's the case in which you're willing to expend a lot of permease on other things. And I don't think the cell is willing to do that.
A lot of something.
Well, can we test this? I mean,
but precisely that's exactly what I'm going to do. So I'm going to try and test it.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is all I'm saying is it's an interesting idea. Right? It explains phenomenologically why a cell might want to do this. It explains some of the observations of 50-year-old experiments.
I know, I would still want you to get into this thing of how you now, the homogeneous...
Great. So the question, is...
The new homogeneous population owns green.
So these guys are cells that are expressing, for example, a lac permease. Okay? And they're growing, and they're growing, and they're growing. Right? And they seem to be homogeneous. They're not. They're heterogeneous in the expression of every other permease they got, which nobody looks at. Every other permease.
But again, this is not genetic.
No.
It's stochastic.
Oh, Oh, I'm sorry, these cells are not stuck. It's like, you saw Michael's experiments. There's about a one and a half generation time scale to this thing. Cell is expressing one permease, and then something else, and then something else. These cells are in a starving population. They're just searching.
I guess we probably have an intuition difference, which is that you're saying that they're doing this to as an energy trade-off.
Yes.
And I would say, my guess would be that they're doing this as a... like more of like an evolutionary thing, not in the sense of they don't want to commit to lactose with their whole population.
But remember, it's not just
the same thing.
Evolutionary and energetic is the same.
Oh, not the same thing at all. I'm saying that this is an actual strategy devised by the cell because you don't know if you have enough
lactose. I agree with you.
You don't commit your entire population.
I agree with you.
And you're saying that they didn't have a choice because it cost too much to make enough permeates.
Same thing. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's because, but
it's not quite the same thing. It's
similar. That's how you would select. If you had a growth condition, then you would select for that kind of strategy. That's how you select.
I understand.
The only reason the cell would be around, your kind of cell, with the correct strategy, is that it was growing faster. They're very closely related. You select for the fast-growing cells. That's what evolution does.
But I mean, you're putting something on there that doesn't have to even... With what I'm saying this is a design principle, and you're saying that this is an energy trade-off.
Okay, so this is sort of a creationist versus... it's not a design principle, it's evolution.
These are totally different things. I don't get why...
Okay, fine. So this is, again, another argument that's...
I don't think you're really disagreeing.
No, we're not disagreeing. I think we're not disagreeing, but it's a question of word use. So, but just to finish off the slide, I'm not saying that the response time is the thing that's key here. It's the amount of permease that you're going to spend in getting that response time, which controls the slope of your growth. Okay, that's the key. It's not response time. The key is really how much wasteful stuff the cell is doing. It's really growth. And so if you had a cell that was able to grow much faster, it would be selected. In other words, cells that use this strategy are going to be present in your population much more than these, just because they tend to grow faster. All the time, not just when switching.
So, if you're saying, let's go put in a hypothetical experiment that would separate the two things.
No, not put in a real experiment. Okay. So,
you did this experiment?
No, no, I'm planning this experiment. I'm just telling you the experiment that we're planning here. So, this is just, I'm going to give you the plan, and then the measurements are going to be conducted, and get back to my lab. So this is it's an excellent system on which to study these kinds of issues. Okay, it's called the PTS, it's called phosphate transfer system. It's in E. coli. Okay? So here is glucose outside the cell, here is glucose inside the cell. And what the PTS does is it provides the energy required to take up this glucose against a gradient. Okay, the energy comes from a phosphoryl donor called PEP. And this phosphoryl group gets transferred to one enzyme, and another, and another, and another, and then to glucose. They're sucked into the cell. So, for those who remember their biochemistry, PEP is the thing that comes at the bottom of glycolysis. Okay? So there's sort of glucose, and then it goes through all kinds of steps. One ATP is released, becomes PEP. It's converted to pyruvate, and another ATP is released. So this is very central. In those metabolic diagrams we had with the, just above the Krebs cycle, is PEP. What does the system do? Well, it definitely integrates intracellular. You were asking, Ila, about what signals is it integrating and all that. It's taking in intracellular signals like metabolism and glycolysis and energy consumption, which is ATP. Extracellular signals, which is sort of glucose concentration. And then it's an amazing thing that this enzyme is the one enzyme in E. coli that activates adenyl cyclase and goes all the way down to the cyclic AMP pathway. So this is inside the cell, outside the cell, and pleiotropic effects. So it's right in the center of what's going on in these cells. So the other cool thing about this is that this PEP donor not only gives phosphoryl groups to glucose, but also to fructose, mannose, sorbitol, mannitol, about 10 different sugars, not lactose, but about 10 different sugars. Okay? And each of these sugars has a module that looks like lacopron. Right? So you have the permease, which is expressed, which takes in the sugar, which generically tends to upregulate the sugar expression. Okay. So here you have a system where you have decisions being made between different carbon sources, and the real question is how much of these permeases are being expressed when that's not the mode the cell is growing in? Right? How much is the basal expression level and how much is the heterogeneity in the basal expression level of these permeases? Okay, so
the fact that it's going to be noisy doesn't really prove that it's
not possible. It doesn't prove at all. So, and it's very hard to prove things about optimality, but the kinds of experiments you can do is just to...
The issue would be if it's really evolved to be optimal, if it's the evolved strategy, what you do is you would test your lab type relation, and then you would evolve your lab strain for 500 generations by
from one medium,
moving it randomly from sorbitol to lucitol. And a sensible bacteria would then just start expressing those two.
Only those two.
Only those.
And not others. Yeah, that's certainly true, right? If you select for growth on sugars, then you express them constitutively.
So. And actually, another option would be to play with the effective population size, right? Because if you have a very small population size, you're not going to get all these variants that have a lot of one or the other, and so that strategy is going to not work as well as when you have a much larger population size where you always have guys.
But unfortunately, then they'll just die. If they're too small, then we don't know what's coming, they will die. But one way to do it is maybe a sort of theoretical way which you might like is with the same number of molecules, can I have. Oh, are you up?
Just go on.
I've done a very bad thing. I've
canceled
my talk, but I didn't tell everybody that it's canceled.
We just
did it yesterday.
Mm. So, should
I
have
your talk? So, I think he's.
That's
so, Boris, if we say, what do we get to see?
So you get to see the tail end of a most interesting talk. But it's over.
No.
So, wait. So the question. So the to answer this question, you could do it theoretically, but it's hard to prove it experimentally. Anyway, that would be the end of the talk. So just leave you with a picture here. So these are. This is true. This is what happens. These cells are exceedingly heterogeneous. You know, they're making decisions for themselves, and they're completely unpredictable. They're almost individuals, right? It's like the people you work with. So just my acknowledgement slide. My PhD advisor and then Boris. So these folks are people in my lab. Ethel in particular did a lot of the experimental work along with me, and Sebastian as well. Huh? Is there any mean? No, actually it doesn't. I actually move these around randomly at every talk, just so that people don't get upset. So, thank you. We should talk.
Okay, so I can give you an experiment then.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't need to be hypothetical, this is probably pretty trivial to do, which is that what you're claiming, one consequence of what you're claiming, which is what I'm saying, is that if you added eight copies of this lac Y, okay? You're saying that if that cell competed with a cell with one copy of lac Y, that the extra energy that's required to make these extra copies of the permease would give it a detrimental.
No, it's not just the eight copies, but it's the eight copies of everything else that it also has to make.
Yeah, so multiply it by
10.
Yeah.
Or actually, so there's 200 permease. You don't know what the factor is, multiply. Let's say multiply by 10.
Yeah. Let's say multiply by 10. Let's do it that way.
So the fact is that 10 copies of permease is not enough. The correct threshold for fairly rapid response, if you use the biochemical numbers from the lac operon, you've got 100 copies of permease.
And the real cells are certain.
In the induced cell, they have about 1,000 or 2,000 permease.
No, but the cell...
But you're saying that
the cell which start growing fast.
Yeah, it has to be measured at that resolution.
But you're saying the stochastic fluctuations are they average around 1, and yet they fluctuate to...
So this is the question, how come there's so much variability in permease? It's not the permease number. It actually comes out of repressor concentration. The effect of repressor concentration changes from 0 to 4 or 6.
So one thing that, I mean, it's quite amazing is that for most of these guys, right, the enzymes that actually eat the stuff are in the same operon with the permease, right?
So somehow, all this stuff is not important enough that they have a separate decision of how much permease to make and how much of the enzymes to make.
No,
these things seem to be just
everything together.
So doesn't that sort of indicate that maybe it's not that clever what the cells are doing? Right? Because they're just turning these things on in the same amount at the same time, right?
It's reasonable to turn them all on at once because you're making use of things quickly and you can make up stories, it's hard to say. You're saying you should actually first check what's out there and then start committing other
things. Well, if you really want this heterogeneous sort of population stuff, maybe you want all the permeases to be, their expression to be independent of expressing other stuff, right?
No, unfortunately the other stuff is necessary. Usually you don't just need the permease, but once it enters the cell, the induction mechanism itself requires about 2 or 3 little proteins. So they just leave the sugar phosphorylated to bind to the transcription factor. So it takes more than one protein. In fact, in the case of the lactoferrin and lactose, it takes Y and Z.
You need to transmit the signal.
Transmit the signal. Exactly.
Okay. I think the beauty of this is, not only it can be checked that there actually is this the random expression of permease at low level,
mm-hmm.
but then I can try to evolve the probability of the level of fluctuation.
You can look at Lemsky's
strange bug camps,
right?
They've been running on two sugars forever.
Right.
But I know what those phase do. They're constituted for certain permease expressions. So I don't know what happens to the rest of the bug. But,
But he would just get rid of all the other stuff.
So what's the range of permeation?
Should we thank Mokon?
Here you are.
Yeah.